This is Progressive Radio, a weekly conversation hosted by Matthew Rothschild, editor of The Progressive Magazine, a leading voice for peace and social justice. For more information about Progressive Radio or The Progressive Magazine, log on to our website at progressive.org.
I'm Matt Rothschild, and welcome to Progressive Radio, which you can also grab off our website over at progressive.org. I'm delighted to have in the studio with me today the human rights activist Sol Thea Kelly-Jones. I've known her since she was a little girl when I coached her in soccer with my son, and I've seen her address crowds when she must have been all of 11, maybe 12, speaking on behalf of LGBT rights, and I just had the privilege of attending her play, The Birds That Are Your Hands, How to Start a Fire Under Siege, which deserves, to my mind anyway, a national tour. Sol Thea Kelly-Jones, welcome to Progressive Radio.
Honored to be here.
Tell me a little bit about your background and how you became a human rights activist.
Well, I grew up in a family that was always passionate about all different struggles for justice. And from my earliest years, being involved in human rights work, from everything from economic justice to LGBT rights, growing up in a family that was lesbian-parented family, it always felt vital and important to be involved in the struggle and to be sharing stories and representations that we don't see everywhere, and stories that are so often, I think, relegated to the margins. And so from that, and I think from feeling the sting of injustice from my youngest years, I always wanted to be able to use my voice in any way that I could to further the cause for justice. And as I grew and came into my own in different ways, I continued to feel the strength, I think, of art in change-making as well, and different ways to create platform and carve out space for stories, and how powerful the personal story could be in change-making. I think even in my own experience as a young person, in sharing the story of my family, in sharing what it meant to grow up in a lesbian-parented family, in sharing our difference and also sharing our humanity.
How was that, Sol?
It was hard.
You talked about the sting of injustice.
What
was that like?
It was from my earliest years, seeing my family not fit, seeing my family also face kind of the systemic discrimination that gay and lesbian people still face in our nation, but also not having the same human rights, not having access to health care, not having a legal relationship with one of my parents. So both in the legal aspect, but also because my family spoke out and because we're open and honest, also facing the backlash that you get, facing the homophobia, facing everything from the bomb threats to the targeting.
You had bomb threats at home?
We had bomb threats at home.
Did those come by mail or by phone?
You know what? I don't even remember. But I remember hearing about it and the kind of trauma and stress around it. And so I think that happens when you speak out, and when you speak out about things that are on the edge. And I think sometimes those are warning signs that you need to take, and I think sometimes they're warning signs that these are important issues to be pushing and to be challenging.
And did you yourself get grief in school or
in neighborhood? I did, especially during middle school. I think there's such lack of understanding and such fear. And so I think for myself, in knowing I could always go home to a supportive family that loved me and would care for me, I felt it was even more my responsibility to continue to speak out and to continue, I think, to break this deadening silence.
And so you also talked in that great opening of yours about the strength of art. And how did that come to your awareness?
Good question. Well, as a young person, I always was performing constantly. And I loved it and always felt alive in creating art. But I think as I came more into activism, and specifically after September 11th and being in high school and wanting to open up dialogue and challenge what was going on and create a space for dissent and create space for actual conversation and critique, I gave up a lot of art. And I kind of went in different political activist realms that oftentimes were disconnected from art making. And for me, I felt how important it was to connect those once again. And actually, in my work in an organization I worked on co-founding in Madison called Proud Theater, which brought together LGBTQ youth, youth from LGBTQ families, allied youth, to kind of tell our stories and create theater right out of our experience. And for me, in that, seeing the process of creating theater as change making, as justice making itself. So it wasn't just the product that you did in the community, but it was also the whole process of working and the change that happens within people, the change that can happen within communities. So I think my passion for activism and my passion for art, I saw them as inseparable.
I'm speaking with this extraordinary person, Sol Thea Kelly Jones. She's a human rights activist. She's a playwright. And I just had the pleasure of seeing this incredible play, The Birds That Are Your Hands, How to Start a Fire Under Siege, which she wrote and directed. Do you prefer writing and directing to acting? I noticed you weren't acting. What was that decision about?
It's exciting to be in a different role. And I love the directing. I love being able to put all the different pieces together and to work kind of on the broader vision of it. But I still love acting. But it's a new realm I'm moving into that I'm enjoying greatly.
Tell me about the background of the play, because the play deals with two big human rights issues right now, the issue of Israel-Palestine and the issue of immigration on our southwestern borders.
Yes. Actually, last year at this time, I was spending time during the spring in the West Bank, in Israel and in Palestine, and working both on human rights work, but also working in theater, particularly with Palestinian and Israeli and international human rights workers in refugee camps throughout the West Bank. And my work has really been in theater and anti-oppression work. So kind of coming back from the things I was talking about with Proud Theater, but how theater can also be an intervention in a state of human emergency, how it can be a place to both resist and explore resistance, but also to unburden from violence and how violence is internalized.
How did you find a place to connect there? Were you with the International Solidarity Committee or were you with a different group?
I was not. I actually went independently. And so I went mostly with arts organizations, local kind of grassroots Palestinian arts groups, and different local human rights groups. So it was everything from activists against home demolitions in Israel, so the Israeli Committee Against Home Demolitions, to the Christian Peacemakers team, to an organization called Project Hope that's a local Palestinian NGO in the city of Nablus. So I connected wherever I could, but my interest was really on a grassroots level, how people were using art to reimagine justice making, to look at different forms of representation, to look at when you think of a people living under occupation, how can you resist in different ways? What are ways when even a culture feels under attack that there can be kind of creative counter narratives that are shared? How can you work with young people who have internalized the occupation in huge ways, not only to unburden, but to start imagining alternatives, even within their own lives? So kind of as trauma intervention work, but also as resistance. So that was my work in the West Bank.
Well, and let's stay there for a second.
Please.
You were working with both Israelis and Palestinians at the same time, and what was that interaction like?
It was very interesting to me. I obviously have not been in the occupied territories before, but my experience so strongly from the Israelis that we're working as well is we need to end this occupation for the future also of Israel, for the future of our people. And there was a huge sense of solidarity. There was a huge sense of this isn't the time. I think a lot of times we talk about peace as holding hands. There's actually a character in the play, a Jewish woman with Women in Black, and she talks about a Jewish Israeli woman, you know, I'm enough of this, like, talking of drinking tea together, and now is the time for us to struggle together. So there's this sense of this discourse we hear all the time about peace actually suffocates and whitewashes over the real struggle of justice making. So I saw incredible collaboration, but I also saw the deep limitations when you start looking at power. There's another character in the play that's a clown that talks a lot about how exciting it would be he's a Palestinian man, how exciting it would be to collaborate with Israeli clowns too and kind of come together united under this love of the laugh. But he shares these huge limitations even in meeting together, even in him ever being able to travel to Jerusalem. And without, I think, a larger critique of power, without a larger critique of differential access, without a larger critique of ending the occupation, I think it's that the pathways to solidarity are really broken down.
There's another interesting interplay of characters in The Birds That Are Your Hands, Solthia Kelly Jones, and that is the gay relationship between the Israeli and the Palestinian, because there's an obvious attraction, there's a obvious love, but the disparate power places really ruins it.
Exactly. I think it's so interesting in that, too, if you look at all these ways, we talk about reconciliation, all these ways that it can be bridged, but then seeing the real limitations.
Do you have any hope after having been there about how a resolution might happen there?
That's a good question. Honestly, it was so much more heart-wrenching and heartbreaking and hopeless. I think when we're at a distance viewing these issues, it can be easier to have solutions or to think that something could work. And we're on the ground and see how sustainable the occupation is in so many ways, even economically sustainable, but also seeing how entrenched it is and how much worse it is getting. Kind of in these, we talk about the extraordinary violences of everything happening in Gaza, but then you also look at these everyday violences, I think, that are slowly crushing not only a desperate people, but any possibility for peace. However, at the same time, and I think this play comes out of this, while we're at this very desperate place, I think in this place of real crisis, I think for me, standing in a place of great privilege and great access, to not believe that we should do everything in our power to not only end this, but also carve out space for a different future, would feel shameful and I think like an ultimate betrayal to people in the everyday.
There's also an incredible, heart-wrenching scene in line there with Palestinians waiting to get through a checkpoint where one father is retelling the story of how his wife was trying to get through the checkpoint. She was about to deliver the baby, and they wouldn't let her through, and the baby dies. That was a very emotional scene, and evidently there are such scenes that actually happen.
There are such scenes. The interesting thing about creating this play, for me, it was a very wrenching process in a lot of ways because there's so many stories that can't be shared. So it's choosing what can be, and everything in that way is kind of a composite story. And this one father, Mohammed, that you're talking about, exactly, who loses his baby at a checkpoint, he's a real story, but he comes out of many people's stories. But it's a thing that frequently happens. Women giving birth at checkpoints, not being able to make it to the hospital. They're seeing it as one of the great kind of human rights crises for women right now. An interesting parallel to the U.S.-Mexico border. Actually, there's so many women, migrants who cross, who are actually pregnant, and in the crossing across the desert become dehydrated and actually are forced into labor and birth their babies before the babies are ready and before they're ready, and so almost a forced abortion. So if you look at different forms of population control and even where we're thinking of maternity and birthing.
Literal population control and metaphoric population control.
Exactly.
I'm speaking with Solthia Kelly Jones. She is the playwright of this astonishing play, The Birds That Are Your Hands, How to Start a Fire Under Siege. I'm Matt Rothschild. I'm the editor at The Progressive Magazine. You're listening to Progressive Radio. Tell me about your experience then in the Southwest.
Absolutely. So actually, just about a week after I returned from the West Bank, I went down to the U.S.-Mexico border and worked with a really incredible organization in Tucson, Arizona, that works on human rights and kind of basic services for the migrant community, but also kind of the broader community of Tucson area. And what we're seeing right now with the construction of the wall along the U.S.-Mexico border is that migrants are actually being pushed and funneled into the desert to cross. And obviously, when you're crossing in the middle of brutal, brutal conditions, you're seeing a rising death toll, but you're also seeing rising human rights violations. And when you think of militarization of the border, it's actually extending so much beyond that. And almost we see this whole border area, but also an entire country in many ways, being more militarized. And so I worked kind of in basic human rights work there. So everything from documenting deaths to working with people who had come in who had just been abused by Border Patrol to people that were separated from their families and didn't know where everyone was. So it's kind of basic legal services in that way, but also basic kind of human rights services. And one interesting thing for me, the parallel, the first day I was in Tucson, there was a story of a Border Patrol agent who had shot a man in the back multiple times, a Latino man who was crossing, because he had a stone in his hand with the intent to throw. And so having just come from the West Bank and hearing that all the time as young people were shot and were maimed and were killed because of holding stones with the intent to throw, how could you not see these parallels? How can you also not see these parallels when you talk about one issue that's brought up in the play, too, is kind of looking at indigenous rights in both locations and drawing parallels kind of to the history of manifest destiny here and the history we talk about with birthright and promised land. So these kind of languages that oftentimes disappear people who have been there in indigenous populations and racialize these people. So kind of in a similar processes, so this is one thing I was very interested in creating this work, is while they're very different issues, even the companies that are building these two walls are the same. We look at similar processes of deeming a people as other. So like the words terrorist, right, that kind of erase a human being. And these words illegal that in a similar way deem someone as other, as criminal.
How long were you down there working? And,
so I was down there.
And tell me about some of the people you worked with.
Absolutely. I was down there from May through August. And it was during the summer. So that's one of the most intense times with people crossing as well, because you have soaring temperatures. And also you have people thinking this would be a really good time to cross. So the people I worked with every day, I worked with incredible activists, I think, in the local area, people that had been around working on the United Farm Workers Movement. So these fabulous kind of elder Chicano activists who had really been with things and continue in that spirit, which was inspiring to me as a young person to continue, and as an ally and as a white person.
There are church solidarity, Central America solidarity people there too.
There are actually the building that I was in, so interesting. It was this old adobe kind of rusting, crumbling, very grassroots place. And it had been used during the sanctuary movement to house people coming up from Guatemala and El Salvador. So kind of that legacy even being built in, kind of a similar movement people see in a lot of ways. But every single day there would be workers who would come in who hadn't gotten their pay. People that literally were put in chains to pick vegetables. People that a woman, actually a pregnant woman, who was beaten by Border Patrol agents, taken to a hospital where she was having her baby and was deported before she could see her child. So every single day, these kinds of things, and people coming in, describing what their family member looked like. Oh, they had a tattoo right here, or oh, I think she had barrettes in her hair, something of this sort. And hoping that they would be found, hoping that their body would even be able to be identified in the desert. And then also a greater trauma of a community of documented people who are also Latino, and seeing that it's not just people without papers, but it's almost an entire community that is deemed as outside. And when you look at the Southwest and you look at so many people who are like, we've been here and this is where we're from, you know, the border crossed us, but also many in Latino and Chicano communities who don't even speak Spanish yet are being asked for their papers. A young coworker I worked with who's pulled over almost every day for following distance, where his car is checked and he's pulled out and policed. And I think we see this in our community in Madison, kind of a greater place of being suspect, a greater sense of being criminal.
I'm speaking with Sol Thea Kelly Jones. She's a human rights activist who's been to the Southwest on the border there. She's been to the West Bank. And she's now put those two things together in a play called The Birds That Are Your Hands, How to Start a Fire Under Siege. When did you decide or know that you had to put the things together and do this play?
It's interesting. I had thought about it before I was in both of the places, but I wasn't really sure. And as soon as I was in Tucson, and as soon as I was there, even with the stone throwing, it clicked that this has to happen. I had a long conversation with an elder Tohono O'odham woman, and so that's one of the First Nations that's on both the U.S. And Mexico side of the border. And the border wall actually severs this very community. And just her language of talking about not even being able to go to her mother's house without helicopters following her. And I thought of these same stories happening over and over and over again, and thought about even the economic imperatives, I think, of looking at free trade, looking at NAFTA, looking at these processes of people in a lot of ways, a lot of people we see from Guatemala coming up, who we've been involved in genocide in their country, very much as the United States, and have been involved in dirty wars. And so you see people that have been displaced again and again through different means. You see people that are just trying to survive. But you also see people of incredible resistance. And that's one of the things I wanted to do in the story, is be able to seek an honest telling of these stories, but also carve out space, not tell the stories for people, but really create space for these stories. I think a lot of times we talk about balance and we talk about needing to have all sides of things. And for me, I think there's one story we eat every morning for breakfast when we wake up. And my passion and my dream has really been to create space for the stories we don't hear.
What's the story we eat every day for breakfast?
I think the story we eat every day for breakfast is Palestinian as terrorist, is Mexican migrant as threat. I think so often everything we need for security. Right now, recently, we just saw a contract with Obama, a new contract with a mercenary group in Illinois that's similar to Blackwater in some ways, that just got a contract for security in Israel and Iraq. So these issues, we hear this rhetoric every single day. We hear rhetoric of security. We hear rhetoric of militarizing our border. We hear rhetoric of securing the border. But what does that actually mean? And who are the people behind these walls? And who are the people that we never see? There's a young boy I worked with, a young Palestinian boy, and he was doing a skit and doing this play, and then he wouldn't do it anymore. And I kind of was trying to ask him, you know, what was going on? Why wouldn't he do it? And he said, you know, I could scream. I actually use this part in it. You know, he's like, I could scream, I could plead, I could beg, I could pray, I could do anything, but it wouldn't matter. He said, one must have ears to hear. And I think, where are we as the international community, as people in our own community, that we can turn our backs and not hear and not see? And I want to create something that offers us the opportunity to see, but also puts it on us. Where are we? What can we do? How can we undo this, right? Where is our responsibility in all this? How do we take, not only in a global sense, but how every day do we deem people as other? How every day do we participate in these systems of racism, these systems of oppression?
It's so easy not to hear, though. I'm speaking with Sol Thea Kelly-Jones. And so how do you get people to hear? That's the question. And you're using art as your tool. And, you know, I do my little thing at the Progressive Magazine on this radio show, and I like to go to as many demonstrations as I can and just walk with everybody else and be participating in that, because I see you at some of those when you're here. And that is a way to try to get people to hear. But that's a dilemma, isn't it?
It is a dilemma. I think it's so easy not to right now. One thing that was so interesting to me in both the West Bank and on the U.S.-Mexico border is the vibrant, nonviolent movements of resistance.
And we don't hear much about that.
And we don't hear much about that at all. But people, every single Friday, that would come, and it would be oftentimes these groups of Israeli anarchist kids that would come and stand with kind of elder Palestinians in these protests against the wall, and would come every Friday and would come back every Friday after that. And these amazingly creative, vibrant protests, everything from having someone one day had mirrors, little mirrors that said stop the wall, and on they kind of, you know how you can tilt mirrors so there's an image that's seen, and on the soldiers that were standing with their, you know, M16s and tear gas and everything reflected it so that on their uniform it would say stop the wall. So I think from these very, very creative things to young students I saw of mine, filling the streets in protest. And I think that is what we don't see. That is what we don't hear. And what we hear of is a rocket. We don't hear the, you know, great, great multitudes of people resisting in all different ways. I think one of the things I wanted to show in this, and that's part of the subtitle, is how to start a fire under siege, is the different ways that fires are kindled constantly of resistance. And yeah, we can't see most of those. But everything from children with stones, to mothers that continue to live, to people that continue to plant their fields, to people that remain, to people that continue to kindle both home and place and belonging, even being in the in-between of crossing, to people that I think we saw during these incredible student walkouts and strikes for immigration rights in the past few years across the country, to young people that said, our parents aren't illegal, we're never going to be illegal. You know, this is we want our rights and our dignity too.
There's a philosophical aspect to this play where you raise the question that you were just talking about, Solthia Kelly Jones, and that is this question of violence and when, if ever, it is justified. You have a Palestinian woman, if I'm remembering correctly, who says, you know, who looks at her hands and says, you know, this is all we have here, and people are shouldn't be surprised that we're violent. They should be surprised that we're not more violent.
Exactly.
And I'm wondering how you wrestle with that philosophical question.
It's a really good question. And I think ideologically I can be in one place and then also recognize that I feel like it's not my right or my place to define a people's resistance for them. I also think of how we disappear all different realms of nonviolent protest and do not see. And it's complicated for me to even think of a protest in the West Bank as being nonviolent when we see soldiers firing on children. There was one protest I was at kind of in solidarity, and there was lots of Israeli activists and lots of international activists, and it was this really like big, exciting thing, and we're marching, and I was like, oh, we're finally doing something that feels so good. And we walk up, and people wait for about 10 minutes and then run. And I thought, why? This is the most anticlimactic protest I've ever been at. Why are people running? But in a moment, the army will fire. And every day you see young people that are killed. You see there's been, you know, American activists and Israeli activists that have been fired at. I have a very good friend of mine, an Israeli man, who he talked about the first time he ever joined a protest in Israel. Everyone said, he went into the West Bank. And they said, oh, you know, they're just going to kill you. These Arabs are just going to kill you. And he was a little scared, but he went anyways. And on that side, he started hearing gunfire. And he thought, where is this gunfire, you know, coming from? Oh, for sure, they're going to kill me. And he looks, and it was a soldier. And he goes up to the soldier, and the soldier says, soldier's like, what are you doing here? And he says to the soldier, what are you doing here? And the soldier says, I'm just following my orders. And he said, for him, and as an Israeli Jew, you know, immediately he thinks back to what he's always been taught about how can you always follow orders, what that means kind of in a Jewish consciousness. What that means. So I think, anyway, so in looking at protest, I think that's really important to look at, that there people are constantly nonviolent. This one character you're talking about is a Muslim woman, and one of the things she says is we're all constantly waiting. We're at checkpoints waiting. We're repairing. Every moment we are nonviolent. She says, every moment we do not destroy you. You know, she says, Gandhi has nothing on us. Look. And she says, look at all that we don't do.
Solthia Kelly Jones is talking about her play, The Birds That Are Your Hands. There's also a poignant old Israeli man, an actor playing an old Israeli man who says, I've lived too long, or I've seen too much. That really got me. And I think it got people in the audience, too. So we're almost out of time. Do you know if someone is listening to the show right now and is very curious about this play, how that person might find out more information about it? Is there any way they can go, or they're just going to have to wait until you travel around the country with them?
Well, actually, they could contact Birds, BIRDSRARE, hands, at gmail.com. And if they want to find out more information, right now, we are very community-based and doing this right here. But really, the goal of this and the hope is really to open up conversation and to rupture some of the silence and to create something that's subversive but is also maybe a scream or a prayer or a plead or an opening for a different way in our world.
Well, I'm all for that. And Solthia Kelly Jones, thanks so much for being my guest.
It's an honor to be here.
Today's program is available online at progressive.org. You can also write to us at 409 East Main Street, Madison, Wisconsin, 53703. Our music is by Mufa. Progressive Radio is produced by Elizabeth DiNovella and engineered at Audio for the Arts in Madison, Wisconsin.